Do you ever wonder about the stories behind the buildings you live and work in?
I talk to a lot of people who grew up in different high-rise public housing communities, and they talked a lot about floors, you know, knowing their neighbors and being involved with other families on their floor, kids playing together, shared meals, you know, summer times out on the front porches, just a lot of exchange and a lot of camaraderie and hospitality and support that people experience building to building, and particularly people knowing folks on their same floors.
That's Audrey Petty talking about Chicago's Cabrini Green housing project, once home to 15,000 people. It became a symbol of everything that was wrong with public housing, and the city of Chicago tore the buildings down. But Audrey Petty has collected the stories and memories of the people who lived there. One of the things that's surprising in some ways to people who only know the really notorious stories about Chicago public housing, one of the things that's surprising is how many happy memories a lot of people had, especially people who grew up there.
Yes, you know, that was, I have to say that for me, that was the first surprise of the process of talking to people, was the many stories and the detailed stories that people shared. They're happy, they're joyful memories, they're memories of connection with people. And as much as there were difficult stories that were shared, there was a lot of joy and a lot of laughter in the conversations that I shared with people in these interviews.
Mm-hmm. Does one in particular come to mind?
Well, I am thinking of Paula Hawkins. She was a narrator I met pretty early on, and she talked about living at Cabrini Green. She grew up there. She spent the first, I'd say, 13, 14 years of her life there. And she talked about Cabrini Green as being, you know, family reunion all the time. She talked about having the best homemade ice cream of her life there and playing with kids on her floor, them playing the gong show in the summer times, her brother riding his bike and pulling these Evel Knievel-like stunts and all of these mishaps and mischief, you know, that occurred that she shared and enjoyed with her friends there. And that was something that she talked about right away.
Yeah, but Paula Hawkins also, I mean, she had these wonderful memories, but Paula wound up raped in the same project, pregnant at 17, a drug addict, and eventually a prostitute. So, I don't know, the good and the bad so mixed up together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that was the experience for every narrator that I spoke to, really. I mean, to different degrees. For every narrator, there was this mix of emotion, a very complicated emotion, where there could be these equally felt experiences that, you know, the tragic and the joyful side by side. Within one narrator, there could be a great deal of affection and attachment to home, to this place, and also a witnessing and a detailed account of tragedy, of terrible difficulties encountered there as well.
I remember quite a few things about over there. I remember that it's where I first learned how to skate.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have those skates. It wasn't the roller kind, it was the iron wheels.
Okay.
I had the iron wheels, and I used to go back and forth from one end to the hall to the next end, just back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember this one man and his wife, his name was Alvin. I don't know the last name.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so as you're coming around, ours is like a turnaround, a circle. It's still kind of a circle.
Like cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so some guys was there waiting on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was with his wife and daughter. He was with his wife and daughter, and they killed him. He laid on top of his wife and daughter so they wouldn't get shot.
Mm.
They killed him right there in front of his family. We heard the shots. My window was right there.
Mm.
So I remember that.
How old were you when that happened?
I was about 5, 6.
Mm-hmm.
About 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. What did you... I know it's hard to remember, like to go back into your imagination at 5, but what do you remember about that moment, that hearing the noise or putting it together that somebody had been heard?
Well, to just be honest, it wasn't a sound that I haven't heard before. I knew what, you know, my grandma and them had taught us, get up under the bed, you know, don't be looking in no windows or nothing like that. But always after we hear the noise stop, well, I always used to peek up. That's how I knew,
you knew
who
what
it
happened.
Was, because I knew who Carl was, you know. It just felt, back then, it just felt like Providence. It felt like Providence. You know, my surroundings, my environment was poor. You know,
so
elevators never worked. Lights was always out. You know, that's how some of the women was getting raped, because a couple of women had got raped in our building. Because the elevators weren't working, and the, you know, the lights in the hallways and stuff like that was out.
Sounds like a terrible place to live and a terrible place to grow up, which reminds me of another guy you talked to, Eddie Lehman, and he told you about how part of surviving, part of growing up there, was just learning how to navigate, how to get around the homes.
Yes, yes. He spoke in detail about taking the path to school and, along with his classmates, knowing where boundaries were, knowing when they were crossing over into rival gang territory. As a little boy with his other friends who were boys, you know, having to watch out for being chased and being caught and maybe being beat up as a boy who was crossing over into this different part of the neighborhood. And he talks about that a lot, that navigation. And I think for him, it really is a pattern in his whole life. You know, the stories that he shared in the book are about navigating boundaries and sort of learning how to operate in different universes, really, in different, you know, in different realities and different cultures.
And when you imagine the community, the complex in which you lived, how would you describe it? How would you describe Robert Taylor that you remember and that you knew very well?
How would I describe it?
Yeah.
It was a community.
Mm-hmm.
It was some joys and some pains. Back when I was living there, I didn't consider it the ghetto, but once I became an adult and once I see how the rest of the world is living, it was really poverty-stricken and the ghetto. You know, it was a learning experience, and, you know, we had to navigate it real, real closely, because going down the fire lane, it was about a two-block walk from my building to school. But going down the fire lane, we had to really, like, listen to what's going on around us, you know, in case any cars zooming around through the fire lane or shooting or things getting thrown. Because back when I was there, they didn't have the fences on the porches.
Yes.
Where they have the fences up high. When I was there, it was a half a fence. So people would tend to throw things out, you know. So we had to constantly look up, and I seen plenty of water. I seen plenty of furniture get thrown out. I seen a lot of stuff get thrown out until they fenced it up.
So, Audrey, you can see why the city of Chicago finally decided to demolish all of the high-rise public housing. It was a huge decision. It changed the face of the city. And all those people had to relocate. What did that mean to people's lives? I mean, just practically.
What that decision meant was moving, and sometimes moving again and again and again. And in the case of our youngest narrator, Tiffany Tucker, she described multiple moves with her sisters and her brother and her mother, and moving to places, and this was sort of in this moment of real estate bust in, you know, nationally, moving to places that were foreclosed and then foreclosed again and then foreclosed again. And this was when she was still in high school. Her brothers and sisters were still going through school, elementary and high school. And her mom works and worked full time at a fast food restaurant on the edge of the city. So in practical terms, what this meant was a great deal of upheaval for them, and, you know, trying to find places that felt solid, encountering landlords who had different approaches, some friendly, some maybe more suspicious of them coming with housing choice vouchers, family with kids. Tiffany talked about the scrutiny she felt in some places, that sense of being watched and not being trusted, of finally finding a place that did not foreclose, where they had good relationships with the landlord. But that was, you know, that was over a matter of years, lots and lots of moving around.
Now, a lot of people you talked with told you that they'd actually gone back to try to take away a brick when the buildings mm-hmm. were torn down, just as a kind of memento of the place that lived. That was so surprising. Why do you think people did that?
I think that it was a gesture, an action to mark this, to take something that marked this place, that marked this spot. I feel like I understand it, you know, from a very removed place of not having lived inside, but to have these places suddenly be gone, and several narrators talk about the disorientation of that. One narrator, Sabrina Nixon, describes going back on, you know, she didn't want to go back, but she found herself on the bus going back in this direction and feeling, as she put it, feeling lost in her own neighborhood, not knowing exactly where she was, even though she could look at the street signs and finally figure it out. And so I think that that gesture of going back to take something to mark, you know, to hold on to, I completely appreciate it, you know, as a measure of evidence, you know, a measure of keepsake to hold on to something when everything else is physically gone. I think it was an astonishing experience for a lot of narrators for these places to suddenly be gone.
In the street, on the corner, in the street.